We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
According to the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, 1 in 10 men experience depression and anxiety. The study even shows less men will receive treatment. To learn more about the silent killer, we have UPMC clinical psychologist Dr. Rafat Omar here to talk about it. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm well. I'm really glad you're here because this topic is so important. Why is talking about it beneficial?
Yeah, first, thank you for having me. I agree it is a really important topic. But, you know, talking about it is beneficial to normalize the idea of not only men struggling with mental health conditions, but also talking about it with their friends, family, and, you know, going to get treatment. You know, use the term silent killer, and it's so true. You know, just the rates of men committing suicide is disproportionately high compared to women, and a lot of times the people in their lives have no idea anything was going on. So it is imperative that we make it normal for people to feel comfortable talking about it.
And we're trying to break the stigmas associated with it. And growing up, I'm sure there's a few men that can agree that growing up, they heard a lot of phrases like be a man or man up. Mm-hmm. How is that not beneficial to positive men's mental health?
Yeah, I mean, it really creates this idea that if you're struggling emotionally in any way, that, you know, somehow you're weak or even flat out denial that these things exist. You're not depressed. You just need to work harder. You're not anxious. You're just being, you know, a scaredy cat or, you know, whatever language they use. But then people, when they're flooded with these messages, they start to believe it. And that causes them to not want to open up when things are going wrong because they know the response they're going to get is negative. So to them, it just feels like there's no point in saying anything because no one listens or cares, unfortunately.
Can you dive deeper into detail why it's called the silent killer?
Yeah, you know, it's exactly how it sounds. You know, these men who unfortunately are driven to take their own lives really show no outward signs that people can detect. Sometimes there are signs that are there that just don't look like typical depression to people. You know, somewhere along the way, we've learned that anger is the only appropriate emotion that a man is allowed to show societally, so the person will become easily agitated. You know, they're flying off the handle more than maybe they used to. And people don't really understand why. So they say, oh, maybe he's just stressed. But really, it's that depression sort of eating away at them. And that's the silent part, that underlying sadness and emptiness that people don't see, hear, or recognize until, unfortunately, it's too late. Or some people, you know, as we know with some of the celebrity cases, right, Robin Williams try to mask it with being jovial and comedic because they don't want people to see what's going on underneath. So it comes as a huge shock and, yeah, silently drove them to end their lives.
It's really interesting if you think about it because we talk about it being a silent killer and men getting struggling to even say that they have help, say that they need mm-hmm. help. How do we get here?
I think we got here from generation upon generation of conditioning that, again, either these things don't exist, they're not legitimate. I mean, if you talk to some older generations, as I see some people who are in their 60s, 70s coming in for treatment, they'll say, yeah, you know, when I was growing up, mental health wasn't a thing. We didn't believe in any of this stuff. And not just some of the more extensive ones that you hear about, like ADHD, you'll hear that a lot. But even things like being depressed or being anxious was just unheard of in that person's day and age. So, you know, all that conditioning over years and years and lifetimes has brought us to a place where there's a lot of men who just don't feel like they can say these things.
You were speaking earlier about not all anxiety and depression looking the same. What can it look like? Because I'm sure when some folks think of depression, they think of, I can't get out of bed, I'm in the dark. Is there, I know it's not a one-size-fit-all, but could you go into detail about what that may look like for others?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's really two major components to depression. There's the absence of activity, which is what you described. I can't get out of bed. Nothing feels enjoyable anymore. I don't have the desire or motivation to do anything. Some social isolation and withdrawal. The person just doesn't want to communicate or see people anymore. And then there's the mood component. For some people, that can be just a whole lot of sadness, negativity, pessimism, you know, feeling like nothing's ever going to work out, some hopelessness, just feeling like, you know, no matter what I do, things will never get any better, and they're just sad all the time. But for another sect of people, that's anger. Like I start to say earlier, you know, just really small things getting under their skin and causing a big reaction, whereas before they were depressed, they could just let those things roll off their shoulders, and that is really troubling to them and the people around them. But, you know, since we think about depression as the sadness, that part often gets overlooked, that agitation, that irritability, that frustration could also be a sign of depression.
Dr. Omar, I've also come across a term, high-functioning depression. What is that, and what does it look like?
That's the person whose activity level may not be as impacted. They're still going to work every day. You know, they're not excessively calling out all of a sudden or anything like that. Outwardly, things seem okay. They're being, you know, relatively productive. Then they get home and they crash, and they don't want to do any of the things that are enjoyable to them. They don't want the social connection. So if you don't know them really well and you don't know what to look for, you wouldn't even be able to tell that they're depressed. And unfortunately, that happens a lot with men and leads to that silent killer that we were talking about, that hidden component beneath it that really impacts them.
What is anxiety? Because you spoke about men also dealing with that as well.
Yeah, anxiety, you know, if we boil it down to the most simple definition, is just fear of the unknown. If you think about that logically, it makes sense, right? People don't know what's coming. They don't know what to expect. They can't control the situation. So, you know, they become fearful, and that makes them really uncomfortable. They don't know exactly how to navigate waters where things are completely unpredictable. So they get that kind of restless feeling, some physical symptoms like shortness of breath, palms sweating. Some people get upset stomach, things of that sort.
How long does it take a person to realize, or how many situations does this have to happen for someone to say, I think I'm depressed, I think I'm anxious?
You know, that a lot of it depends on the person. Some people are really in tune with themselves, and as soon as they start to feel something is a little bit off, maybe once, even twice, they say, oh, wait, something's going on here. Other people, it does take a long time. It might drag on for months. I've seen cases where people were depressed or getting really anxious for years and didn't realize it until they came in, you know, years later. So a lot of it has to do with, you know, how informed and educated about these symptoms the person is, which is what makes months like these so important, to bring that awareness out.
What tips do you have for a person who may be going through this to stay grounded?
Yeah, in terms of depression, you know, the number one tip that I always give people is, you know, look at what you're not doing anymore. The first things we lose are the ones that don't have any like immediate outside consequence, right? So like if you stop doing your hobbies, you're not getting fired from your job, there's no real risk, anything like that. So if you notice that all you're doing is going to work, coming home, and then crashing on the couch, you know, notice what was missing. What are you not doing anymore that used to make you happy, that used to make you fulfilled, and get back to that. And if you're anxious, the biggest tip that I can give people is to try to stay in the moment. You know, that way, say, if we look forward, we get anxious. If we look backwards, we get depressed. So looking ahead too far.
I've never heard that.
Oh, really? Well,
that's,
now you have a new saying for you. But if you think about it, it makes sense, right? If we look backwards on things that happened that we regret or upset us, that's going to depress us. If we look forward, we don't know what's coming. We get really anxious. We get really nervous about the future. So, you know, try to live in the moment as much as you can. You know, if something is coming up that you feel might be an issue, well, hey, it's not an issue right now. Why would I steal my happiness and peace right now for something that may not even occur? So, you know, try to be more present, more in the moment.
I know I don't speak for everyone, especially not men, but it's so hard to do that.
It is. It is. I say it flippantly, but it's not easy to do. It's a skill to be learned for sure.
Mental health is crucial for everyone, also especially men, especially during this month, Men's Mental Health Month, but yet it's overlooked. Dr. Omar, why is that?
You know, we tend to focus more on the things that we can feel physically a lot of times. You know, if your leg is hurting, it's a lot harder to overlook that because you can't really do the same things that you were doing. People don't often think about the toll that mental health takes on them because by and large, unless you get some of the more extreme cases, able to just go on about their day. So, you know, we also have a lot of messaging societally about picking yourself up by your bootstraps and
yes,
toughing it out, and harder to do with a broken arm than when you're feeling depressed or anxious. You know, you still kind of have that mentality of, let me just grit through this. Even if I'm feeling anxious, it'll pass, it'll go. Or some people may not even realize what's happening. And I think that's a big contributor to just the lack of awareness and education causing people to overlook what's going on with them.
Is depression and anxiety, is it also hereditary?
You tend to see it run in families, but a lot of that is more kind of picking up and learning the behavior. You know, if somebody sees that their parent is really fearful of things, they're going to learn to be fearful. You know, kids learn by our actions more than our words. So depressed people, unfortunately, if it kind of continues to linger, can impart that on their kids, because if you really think about it, they're always unfortunately being negative or sad, and that kind of comes into their temperament as well. So, you know, you will see it get picked up that way.
Is there a cure for anxiety and depression?
Yeah, both of those things can be remedied in most cases. It's not super common, but some people do just have a chemical imbalance that causes them to be, you know, persistently depressed. And for those people, they likely will be taking medication long term. But for the bulk majority of people, they can either go through therapy and learn some behavioral techniques and think through the things that are causing them the depression and the anxiety and work through them that way. Or, you know, maybe they take medication while they work on some of those things. And once those symptoms recede, I mean, they don't have to take medication for the rest of their lives, which is something that a lot of people report to me in my work that they're fearful of, is I don't want to take medication for the rest of my life. And for depression and anxiety, for most people, you don't have to. If you can work through it, then you can come off of it.
How come there's some patients who are reluctant to use the medication that you spoke of when it comes to mental illness?
There's a lot of fear of adverse side effects. As we know, some of them do have some negative side effects, so people are fearful of that. There's also a bigger stigma around that in terms of, you know, oh, if you need medication to function, then there's something wrong with you. And that's viewed as a negative thing, even though really there is something wrong and we need to fix it. Sort of like how if you had a headache, you would take aspirin to fix it. Same concept. It just isn't the one-shot deal that like a pain medication would be.
How is it diagnosed? Or any mental illness?
Yeah, you know, through a pretty extensive clinical interview, you know, kind of looking at what's been going on, how long has it been going on. You know, one thing I always tell people is when you think of pretty much any mental health issue, we all experience some flavor of it at some point. You know, everybody gets down. Everybody gets a little worried or anxious or something to that effect. But when it's persistent, you know, it's been going on for weeks or months or years for some people, and it's impacting your quality of life and it's making it difficult to do things, that's when it becomes a diagnosis, and that's when we need to act, you know.
There's so many movements for men's mental health and Men's Mental Health Month. Have you seen more patients that are men coming in to take more, well, better care of their mental health?
I have, actually, yeah. In recent, probably about the last year or so, I've noticed an uptick in men coming in. You know, sometimes they'll say, well, I'm only here because my wife pushed me to, or something to that effect. But you know what? As long as they're coming in the door, that's totally fine. But I have been seeing, you know, not a huge uptick, but more than I previously had.
And if you're just now joining us, we have Dr. Rifat Omar here talking to us about Men's Mental Health Month. He's a clinical psychologist at UPMC. So why is it that men are most reluctant to come in to see what's going on with their mental health?
I think a lot of it goes back to the conditioning and the messaging that they've received throughout their lives, through family, through media, just kind of societal pressure to tough it out and be a man. And, you know, we don't worry about our emotions, right? It's not important to be thinking about your emotions or talking about your feelings. What matters is you get up and you go to work and you support your family. And that messaging is detrimental. I mean, it really makes people think that if they go to seek some kind of help, that they're weak or a failure or not a man. And that's simply not true. It's just part of the human experience.
What can lead to mental health illnesses?
Unresolved trauma is a huge one, especially in things that we might not have recognized as traumatic in the moment, but they sit with us and we continue to think about them and they make us depressed. A lot of stress and pressure that without proper outlets for that stress and pressure can lead to mental health issues. In terms of anxiety specifically, conditioned fear can cause that. You know, being around people who, as you're growing up, are scared of everything or imparting information to you that the world is a dangerous place and you should always be afraid. There's a lot of environmental factors that can cause these things.
When it comes to certain movements, like I've heard Protect Your Peace King recently and this month, why is it important that we continue to have these conversations?
We want it to become normalized, mainstreamed, and even celebrated. We want people to feel welcome and opened and that we care about what they're saying and that we value them as people. And these movements can really help with that by bringing to the forefront things that people have suffered in silence with, too afraid or too reluctant to speak about.
Is there an age group in men where mental health is more prominent?
Not necessarily. I know we're seeing, the suicide rates in younger adult men, but in terms of actual symptoms of depression and anxiety, it really runs the gamut. I mean, people can develop these things and do develop these symptoms at any age, really.
How do we continue to break the stigma?
I think it's partially kind of society as a whole banding together to continue these movements and make sure that they grow in popularity and increase exposure. But person to person, for everyone, just don't be afraid to check in on your friend and let them know that, hey, it's okay for you to talk to me about these things. I won't think less of you. I think especially men to men, having that camaraderie to say, hey, man, I noticed you are behaving a little differently. Is everything okay? Are you feeling down? You can talk to me about these things. And just opening that conversation that way.
Dr. Omar, over at UPMC, how do you help men with their mental health?
I work in our outpatient clinic, Pinnacle Health Psychological Associates. We offer outpatient therapy. We offer medication management. I just try to make as welcoming an environment as I can for men to talk about these things. And letting them know that, hey, I get it. As a man, I heard the same messages, but I'm telling you, it's okay. You can share these things, and I won't judge you for it. And people tend to open up that way.
And what is the process usually for men to come into your office and talk to you? Is it something that's may have been brewing for like a year? Because you mentioned before that some men come in due to their wives.
Typically, people, whenever they have that moment of, okay, I need to see someone, or maybe they were really pushed, but deep down they know they need to, they call in, they make an appointment. A lot of times I get that, oh, so-and-so wanted me to come in, my wife, my family, whatever. But as we get to just kind of talking casually and not a lot of pressure, it starts to come out that they also recognize that there's something going on that they need to have addressed, and then we take it from there.
Is there something that you wish that more people knew about men's mental health?
I wish more people knew that there are a lot of men who deep down want to be able to say these things and not fear that it's going to be held against them in some way. Because that's something I hear really commonly from men. You know, if I say something, my wife is going to hold it against me. My family is going to hold it against me. People are going to make fun of me, throw it back in my face. There are people who feel that way, and I wish that that wasn't the case.
Thank you so much, Dr. Omar, for providing us with so much understanding on how we can break stigmas associated with men's mental health.